Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Madam President, you cannot go back and undo something that you gaveled.
I believe I can.
No, you cannot, Madam President.
Particularly when it violates.
It was reported and approved and gaveled. You cannot go back and undo that. That is a done deal, signed, sealed, and delivered.
When the item that is brought forward, the chairman recognizes that there was brought forth an error when it has not been properly noticed and it violates the Open Meetings Act? We absolutely. Mr. Alderman Beal, please let me just finish and I'll let you respond. The chairman indicated that she inadvertently went through an agenda that was not the correct agenda, that was not properly noticed, and as a consequence would violate the Open Meetings Act. She has come back and corrected the record, as I understand it, and asked that the first reading be stricken. That is entirely appropriate. The item was not in the jurisdiction of the committee.
That's no different than voting on something and say, oh, I didn't mean to vote on that, and go back and change your vote after the gavel is gaveled.
If it's
our rules state that once something is gaveled and approved, it is signed, sealed, and delivered, regardless if it was a mistake or not.
So Alderman Beal, show me which rule says that, because that's not correct.
All right, someone get a referee out here. We need a ref.
That's Alderman Anthony Beal, Ninth Ward, dueling with Mayor Lori Lightfoot. That's from yesterday's show. Excellent job done by the legendary Dave Glowatz picking up that clip. Great debate. Is it signed, sealed, and delivered? Or is it another Stevie Wonder song?
Today's show was brought to you by SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana, the Chicago Federation of Labor, the Chicago Teachers Union.
That's not correct.
Oh, yes, it is correct. Madam Mayor. Chicago Teachers Union and Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky if you want to check out, download any other shows like the interview with Dave Glowatz. Over 1,000 episodes for you to check out. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. J-O-R-A, V as in victory, S-K-Y.
That's not correct.
Yes, it is correct. It is Wednesday, January 5th, and this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, legendary Chicago journalist Monroe Anderson makes his return, and I believe making his Ben Jarofsky Show debut. Is that correct, Ben?
That is correct.
Lee Allen Jones. And now your host, making his Ben Jarofsky Show debut, I think, correct?
Negatory.
Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this COVID Classroom Wednesday, and here's why. Yesterday, as we were discussing the city council maneuvers with the great Dave Glowatz, the city, there was great strife and turmoil in the city of Chicago between the Chicago Teachers Union and Mayor Lori Lightfoot. It'll never end. Monroe Anderson has joined us. Ladies and gentlemen, Monroe Anderson has joined us. I love it when my guests show up early. And folks, you know I'm going to be on the teachers union side. People are going to go, oh, Ben, you're just on the teachers union side because they sponsor your show. There's people out there, those cynics out there. Oh, Ben. I think Monroe Anderson may think that. But where Monroe Anderson is wrong on that point is the reason the teachers union finally got around and took you long enough, guys, to sponsoring my show is I was for the teachers union before many of these people in the teachers union were even teachers. So I'm just going to say that right now. My mother, may she rest in peace. Yeah. Proud member of the Chicago Teachers Union. But this is ridiculous. I'm going to get Monroe Anderson's thoughts on this one after I give mine. He's a little more conservative than I am when it comes to local issues. This is absolutely absurd. The city of Chicago right now has implemented all these rules about when you go into a bar or when you go to the United Center to watch my beloved Bulls. You got to show a card that says you were vaccinated to get in there. or that you passed a COVID test, that your latest test within 48 hours is negative. No such requirement is for a Chicago public school. None. So we're having this huge spike. We got Governor Pritzker. Governor Pritzker announcing put off elective surgeries until later because the ICU units are filled up with COVID patients, unvaccinated people by and large, thank you very much, who got COVID and now are really sick. And now we're learning that this new strain, you get it even if you are vaccinated, even if you have the booster. So it's got people like Monroe Anderson afraid to leave his home. People like me, I'm like half in and half out. And when it comes to the public schools, the city's attitude is like, just shut up and get in that classroom. Don't worry about it. They've been negotiating with teachers for months about that. What is it about Chicago that our city leaders have to reduce everything to like this really painful negotiation where they lock people in a room and there's like no consensus? And it's like, well, we'll get back to you. And then they say one thing one day and then something else another day. And meanwhile, a month goes by. They can't deliver. They say, oh, we're gonna send tests to all the kids in Chicago. Let them take a COVID test over winter break, Monroe. I don't know if you saw this. Here, how about this for confidence in your public schools? Pictures in the Tribune, on the front page of the Tribune, of tests, of the COVID tests that are just like piling up on the sidewalk because nobody's collecting them. And now what they said, I think there's 150,000 tests they sent out and only 11,000 are usable. What a joke. If you're a teacher, why would you trust the leaders of the Chicago public schools to look out for your health? So I don't blame the teachers one bit for saying, you know what, we're going to virtual classrooms only until you guys get a handle on this. And then Lori Lightfoot's like, this is outrageous. Kids have to be in a classroom. Of course, duh. Kids are better off in a classroom. Nobody's arguing that they're not better off. They're better off virtual. Nobody argues that. But the reality is that the Chicago public schools have demonstrated that they're incapable of operating with any kind of health standards that would protect the teachers. And Monroe Anderson will talk about this a little bit, because Monroe, you and I do agree on this, that whereas children perhaps are less vulnerable to this current strain of COVID, teachers as adults certainly are not. So on one hand, Monroe, you got the mayor of the city of Chicago ordering people to show their vaccination cards to get in bars because we don't want to spread this latest strain throughout the city. But, oh, just anybody going to public school, who cares if teachers get COVID? Anyway, I don't blame the teachers one bit. Let's see what Monroe Anderson. Monroe, do you agree with me on this point, or do you vehemently disagree with me? Go ahead.
I disagree with you about my being afraid to leave the house. I go out several times a week. However, you are absolutely 100% right on the teachers and the students. We need in-class learning for the kids. They're not learning anything online. They just aren't. We haven't mastered that. When they first started, they said, well, we don't know what we're doing, but we will before it's over. Well, theoretically, it's over, and they didn't learn anything. The kids didn't learn anything. The educators didn't learn anything. Nobody learned nothing. So then we get to the teachers. Many of them are almost as old as you've been. And therefore, they have to watch their health. And those younger teachers have parents that are almost as old as you. they sometimes meet with their parents for various things. They don't want to impact them. And so we have a complicated situation in that school in-class learning is good for the students and not so good for the teachers. And there's no easy solution to that.
Well, there is no easy solution to that, but there are steps you could take, and the Chicago Public Schools have shown that, have demonstrated time and time again, they're either incapable of taking those steps or they're not interested in taking those steps. And that was on display, as I said, when we saw the pictures of the tests that they had sent out piled high. And they were, Monroe, if you had...
Was that the school teachers or was that your post office?
No, that was the Chicago Public Schools not having a system set up. By the way, don't blame it on my beloved post office. The picture was a UPS store. It was a UPS drop-off.
They're about to fire your friend, you and Trump's friend who was in charge of it.
Hey, man, that's a whole other story. Yeah. I submit to you, to quote the great Harold Washington, I submit to you that the Republicans have been plotting to destroy the post office forever.
Right.
And it's an outrage.
Yes.
We could do a whole show on the post office. And again, you could say, oh, Ben, you're biased because you used to work for the post office and your sister used to work for the post office and your father used to work for the. Yes, I have a bias there, too, for those two institutions, post office and Chicago teachers.
OK, so that's why you love the Chicago Democrats so much. Your family follows in the same tradition.
I got to tell you, I have this bizarre love-hate relationship with Chicago Democrats, Monroe. Yeah, it's true. I am a basket case. We have Lee Allen Jones will be joining us in a little while. He's a writer, as an activist. He's a protege of Monroe Anderson. We're going to be talking Bobby Rush. He used to work for Bobby Rush, so we're going to be talking a lot of Bobby Rush. The teacher's situation with the Chicago Public Schools just like grabbed my attention this morning when I was reading about it obsessively and talking about it on the phone. But really, we're going to do the Bobby Rush deep dive. And when you said Chicago Democrats, it just made me think of Bobby Rush. So we'll take that deep dive before we bring Lee Allen Jones in. And he's already sending me texts. He wants to come in on the show. So might as well send him a link, Dennis. But before we bring Lee Allen in, it is almost one full year. Tomorrow makes it one full year.
Make Lee Allen wait his turn.
Yeah. Make him wait. Make the youngster wait. Monroe, was 1 year ago. I was looking in your eyes, the dismay and shock as you saw Trumpsters overtaking the Capitol, the insurrection in full force as they were trying to overturn the American democracy. They were trying to take an election that Joe Biden won and turn it over to Donald Trump. It was a coup, an unsuccessful one. Here we are, a full year later. Can you believe a year has gone by? And I submit to you, I'm really feeling Harold Washington. I submit to you, Monroe Anderson, nothing was learned. Trump is more powerful now than he was on January 6th. You told me, and I've dutifully watched Steve Kornacki's report on MSNBC, the poll, that a staggering, 45% of Republicans think that the election was stolen for Donald Trump. I mean, you might as well just say they believe that the sun rises in the west and sinks in the east.
Well, there's a reason for that, Ben, that they watch Fox. And Fox has been giving them a steady diet of BS for the past year. I mean, what Fox has been telling them, although they're anchors and show hosts know better, but they've been telling them that the election has been stolen, as Trump says. And so they believe that. And the only two brave Republicans to say otherwise is Cheney and Kaczynski.
No, Kinzinger.
Kinzinger, oh,
yeah.
Kinzinger, yeah.
Yeah, well... it's not much better with independents. I watched the entire report, and I think he said 20% of independents believe, Monroe, that the election was stolen from Trump. They don't believe that Joe Biden legitimately won. That is so bizarre, which leads me to conclude they're not really independents.
Right. They're people because they are. They don't believe that God sent Trump, or they don't believe that Robert Kennedy is coming back to run with Trump. then they think they're independent because they don't believe the most extreme things. But they lean heavily towards Republicans.
Well, they're too embarrassed to admit they're Republicans, which is a really strange phenomenon. I actually believe that people who call themselves libertarian, it's going to be interestingly, Alan Jones calls himself a libertarian. But by and large, people who call themselves libertarian are just too embarrassed to admit they're really Republicans and they hate paying taxes. Because I say in most cases, I don't see anything libertarian about their view, let's say on abortion rights or legalizing reefer or anything like that. It's a fraudulent movement. Just take a look at Rand Paul for a proof of that. All right. Trump is stronger than ever. You said that to me this morning when we were talking, Monroe. A year after the attempted coup, do you believe that Donald John Trump is stronger than he was at this point in January 6th?
Among Republicans, yes. Not among the general public. I mean, if there was an election today between Biden and Trump, and they couldn't steal it, then Biden would still win. But with what the Republicans have done, they've become more radical than ever. What they're doing now is running for offices in counties and states and in key places. And so that they can control the vote. Yeah, you know, it's we talk a lot about gerrymandering and about voter suppression, but he or she who counts the vote decides the winner. Yeah. And so they're trying to get in positions where they're going to be the vote counters, so that they won't make the mistake they made last year.
Yeah, and do you think that the general population is aware of this, or is it only just political junkies like you and me who are following this?
No, they're aware. You know, Bannon sent out an email to all of them saying, "Run for these various strategic offices, so that we can control it next time." Mm-hmm. And you have some Republicans who are saying what normally is said in the quiet room out loud. And that's, okay, we're going to steal it any kind of way we can.
And what I was getting at, yes, I know Steve Bannon put the call out, but I'm just wondering if your quintessential swing voter in Wisconsin that we're always so worried about, or in suburban Virginia, is aware of this or even cares about this. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. Now, they may not care. But they're aware, you know. Even those people who watch Fox, I mean, they know that the fix is in, but they don't care. You know, and this is stereotyping to some degree, but most of the Trump nuts, not all of them, but a lot of them, too many of them, are white men who are failures, or who are just barely making it. And the only thing they had going for them was that they were better than black people and brown people. But with things being so hard and difficult for them, it's not the case anymore.
Lee Allen Jones has joined us. Lee Allen Jones has joined us. We're going to bring him on in just a second, but I want to finish up with Monroe on this point. Maybe we'll see what Lee Allen has to say. Monroe, we have been saying for weeks that this is a race. This January 6th investigation by Congress is a race to see whether they could get their subpoenas in, they can get their testimony in, they can gather evidence before the Republicans take back control of Congress in the November midterms. And it's been pretty obvious to you and me that Donald Trump has commanded his allies and his aides not to cooperate, to take it to court, to challenge every subpoena that is leveled at them in order to drag it out. And then once Republicans take over the Congress, then they can kill this investigation. And I don't know what, launch an investigation into Fauci or something like that.
No, they're going to launch it. Yeah, well, him too. But they're going to launch an investigation until 2020 to prove that the race was, the presidential race was in fact stolen.
Yeah.
And they're going to impeach Biden. That's their plan. They have said that, some of them out loud. That's the program.
And do you think they'll succeed?
No.
So no. Do you think that the Democrats can wake America up long enough to forestall a Republican victory in Congress that will enable the Republicans to carry out this attack against Biden and democracy?
Probably not, but what is going to happen is that the January 6th committee, for example, is civil. It's not criminal. But once they have the goods now, they have the receipts, they're going to give it up, hand it over to the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
And Merrick Garland is going to have to make a decision. And in fact, I think he's going to tell us what that decision is any minute now. He's supposed to come on with a major speech.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of major speeches, Donald Trump was supposed to make one tomorrow. He postponed that. Last week, we were on the show. You and Sergio were sort of trying to predict what it was that Donald Trump was going to say in his speech. Why now do you think he's postponed a January 6th speech?
A couple of things. The Hannity reveal put him in an awkward position. Plus, all the mainstream media people were saying, we're not covering it because he's just going to tell the same old tired lies that he's been telling. So there's no news there. They said, we'll have a reporter there. And if he says something he hasn't said, it's actual news, we will report it, but we're not doing it live. And so now he's decided, well, if I can't lie to him live, then what I'll do is hold a rally and lie to him at the rally. So they're going to have to wait on hearing the same old lies over and over again.
All right, let's bring on Lee Allen Jones. That noise you heard in the background, who's getting his microphone ready to go. He's ready to rock and roll. Lee Allen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, Monroe. Good afternoon, Ben.
Hey, right, Lee Allen.
Lee Allen and Monroe go way back. They've known each other for quite a while. Since he was a teenager?
Yeah. And he's almost as old as you, too, Ben.
Oh, Lord. Monroe Anderson's got jokes today, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Now, Lee Allen Jones, commentator, writer, and the political activist. At one time, it worked for Bobby Rush. We'll get to Bobby Rush in a little while. A Green Party candidate for Senate back in the year 2010. Could have voted for him, ladies and gentlemen. I believe he got 4% of the vote in the general election.
A little bit less.
Well, rounding up, okay?
Yeah, well, thanks.
Rounding up, okay? And so, Lee Allen, you heard Monroe. Monroe is saying essentially that the Republicans are going to try to continue their efforts to have a coup and declare as invalid Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election and declare Donald Trump the winner. And that's what this resistance to the investigation, the congressional investigation, is all about. That's what they're attempting to do by running out the clock on that investigation in the hopes that they'll win the midterms, steal it if they have to, and then turn right around and investigate the Democrats. Do you share Monroe's sense of gloom and doom when regards to the Republican Party?
Well, you got to think of where Monroe's career began. You know, he got hit in the head down there at the Democratic Convention in the late 60s, right? So I think this will be a continuation of that assessment. And I'd have to support him in that based upon his journalistic experience and integrity.
So in other words, when he got hit in the head, it set him right, is what you're saying.
It set him right. He can smell out a conspiracy.
Do you think they're going to get away with it?
I mean, you got to think about it. They have the Supreme Court. They have the court. They have their justices there. Public sentiment is really going to be there. We don't know what's going to happen in the market right now. When you look at the fact of people's financial security, you got COVID, you have all of the things to kind of exacerbate a crisis now. And Monroe's political scenario kind of fits in line with the scorched earth, approach of conservative Republicans as the country becomes more, more liberal and more democratic, and knowing that, those institutions that cannot really sustain within that natural growth and progression of the country are going to do whatever they have to do trying to maintain the status quo.
Monroe, I hadn't thought about the Supreme Court and the role they may play in all this. Is before now, they have they? I was a little pessimistic, Monroe. You remember this? I thought the Supremes would rule on Trump's side when it came to election issues before January 6th, and they didn't second his attempts. They were so obviously bogus,
right?
But they felt compelled to maintain some semblance of integrity, and so they didn't join the Trump crusade.
Their mission, I believe, is to kill Roe versus Wade.
Yeah,
and they don't want anything to get in the way of that. And so if they had backed Trump, then it would have been okay. These guys are a joke. It's nothing balanced about what they're doing. And so they're judiciously being judges on a lot of issues so that they can do what they were sent there to do. That's my take on it.
Yeah. They will overturn. But you know what? I have to ask Lee Allen this before we get to Bobby Rush. Monroe raises the issue of Roe versus Wade. And this is my... I got a bone to pick with libertarians, Lee Allen. I never see any libertarian standing up for a woman's right to choose. I'm thinking of all.
I support women's right to choose.
Okay, one. I see one. You. I don't. Rand Paul, his daddy. I didn't see any of them on the front lines in the fight for a woman's right to choose. And you would think that would be a libertarian crusading cause. They use their rhetoric in their anti-vax campaigns. They just literally stole from abortion supporters with the rhetoric. It's like our body, our choice, that kind of thing. But they're nowhere to be found when it comes to. In fact, I thought they were missing in action in the war against the war on drugs, actually, in my opinion. So what is it about libertarians? Not yourself. I mean, obviously, you're not a Rand Paul libertarian. But why are they just merely tools of the Republican Party?
I think it's all reactionary on both sides. When you look at the left and then when you look at the right, they become very intractable on fringe issues that their philosophies really have already defined what their logic should be in terms of public policy. And so that's why we're in this state that we're in politically right now, because we don't really have sensible leadership that really takes into account what we truly believe in. So, I mean, for me, being a Green, looking at libertarian, is really saying I don't want to be a part of status quo politics, because there's really no growth in status quo politics right now. It's just very intractable. And that sort of leads in, to Congressman Rush and what his choice was to step away. I think if we look at, Congressman Rush's political history, I mean, he's been very fortunate on his timing. I mean, he's been a survivor of politics. I mean, going back to, going to the 60s, he's a political survivor. So for him to kind of bow out at this point and being in leadership, I mean, he hasn't been in leadership a substantial amount of his career. The Republicans control the House. What was the guy's name? Not Mitch McConnell, but what was the guy before him in the House? Newt Gingrich. You got to think the Republicans, they had a significant amount of influence on public policy in the House when Congressman Rush was there. And considering, what came out during that period, I mean, he supported, if you go back and look at his history, one of the first pieces of legislation he supported was conflict resolution in 1992. When we look at what was happening, going on across the country when we came to crime reform by 1994 and looking at where we're at in 2022 in Chicago, with homicide levels that have reached back over that span, and then looking at him stepping aside now, and then looking at just the political demographics that are beyond repair, I think, in the African-American community, is really foreboding. And even his commentary yesterday was foreboding about what he felt politically.
All right. We'll make the transition to Bobby Rush. And before we pick up on your themes that you just articulated, Lee Allen, Monroe, I got to turn to you. You've known Bobby Rush for a long time. Monroe, yes. Anderson.
Yes.
And
30-some years.
30-some. Wow. And he says, I'm old. Monroe, talk a little bit about what you perceive as Bobby Rush's legacy and contribution to Chicago politics. Because when I just mentioned Bobby Rush, I have a flood of memories. I was telling Lee Allen this when we briefly talked before the show. I have a flood of memories that it just instantly come up. But for you, what do you think about Bobby Rush when you think about his career?
Well, you know, Bobby Rush is a friend of mine. We've not agreed on all things. For example, when I was Mayor Sawyer's press secretary, Rush was one of his adversaries at the time, along with Dorothy Tillman and Tim Evans. But we have been friends. Most of the things he's done politically, I've agreed with. Not all. For example, I have never asked him about this, but I will one day. His backing Daley for the mayor's race the last time out. I mean, that just seems so bizarre to me. I didn't understand that at all. You know, so, but then it's no big deal. You know, I sometimes disagree with myself. So you know, it's not like I everything everybody does who I have an association with, that we're in agreement with at all. You know, when Lee Allen ran as on the green ticket, I was trying to figure out why was he doing that, you know, and I asked him that simply because I didn't think it was a good idea. I would not have made that advice to do that, but that was his choice. And it did no damage to our relationship whatsoever. It wasn't like I said, okay, you're doing this. So anyway, back to Bobby. A lot of his politics, very good. And he's committed to most of it. My study of, because I've done research, as you know, I'm writing this chapter on Sawyer, and I've been doing research. And one of the things I have noticed during my research is that while Bobby and Tillman and Evans were all against Sawyer, after Sawyer lost and Daley came into office, then they saw the light. And suddenly they weren't as adversarial as they had been. Mainly because, for example, with Bobby, Madigan gave him some positions. He made him a downstate representative to the legislature for something. You know, so basically, they bought him off without handing him money in a brown paper sack. They figured out a more sophisticated way to do it.
Well, Lee Allen has a very interesting theory that he shared with me briefly before we went on the air, Monroe, as to why Bobby Rush endorsed William Daley. So William Daley, one for our listeners, our younger listeners, is the younger brother of Richard M. Daley, who was the mayor of the city of Chicago in the 90s, in the O's, before Rahm Emanuel. I always feel compelled to just say this stuff because who knows what people really know. And of course, William Daley is the son of Richard J. Daley, who was mayor of the city of Chicago before Lee Allen was born. Throughout the 60s and into the 70s, the powerful Daley family. I must confess, I never voted for Daley. I was stunned when Bobby Rush endorsed William Daley, a millionaire banker. Lee Allen, you have your theory as to why Bobby Rush, who was in the Black Panther Party in the 60s and owes his political career to Harold Washington, why Bobby Rush endorsed William Daley in 2019. Deliver that theory, please.
First of all, I would say in Chicago politics, and I think when you look at that election and knowing the relationship that Bobby had with, or Congressman Rush with Rahm Emanuel, that relationship was significant. And I think when you look at his support of William Daley, it kind of extended from that when you look at the fact that William Daley was a high-ranking official, I want to say, within within the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. And so, you know, based upon that D.C. relationship and then looking at what the constituency that really supports Bobby, which are a lot of the black preachers. And so the black preachers, you know, did very well under the Daley administration. And they had been really, you know, a lot of them that had a lot of support for Daley found themselves on, you know, not necessarily at the top of the food chain during the Emanuel administration. So, you know, that relationship was kind of natural politically, even though if it may not have been natural historically, is that that constituency group, you know, that felt itself marginalized for the two terms of Rahm Emanuel, they wanted to get back in. And looking at the resources that came from the Obama administration and having the federal government, and then, you know, the fact that they didn't really get what they thought out of Rauner and the melee that happened after that, you know, that constituency group, you know, and Congressman Rush would have to look at that constituency group's interest, which is significant within his district, and kind of go with what that consensus was and not going with the emotion, since there was really no consensus candidate that had emerged from the African-American community. And that candidate would have, you know, I think Kara Mosley Braun had ran the first time. She failed. You didn't really have anybody with a significant background that came in. They, you know, they didn't really want to support Toni because she had already had her status quo operation going on. So they were kind of forced to look at who they had had relationships before. And that relationship between the Daley family and the black clergy of Chicago go back very far. You got to remember, the black clergy supported, you know, the father against Martin Luther King when he came, you know, to support fair housing. So that would be nothing new.
That is a sobering thought that Lee Allen just made, Monroe, but it's absolutely true. Martin Luther King brought his campaign to end poverty to the city of Chicago in 1966. And then he had open housing marches. And Leon, you're absolutely correct. Some of the most prominent black ministers in the city of Chicago stood with Daley, Richard J. Daley, in the midst of that.
There's this one black minister, forgetting his name now, but he had a church on what's now King Drive.
Yeah, Jackson.
Jackson. Right, exactly. And he changed the address of the church with his name King Drive.
He
took the side street address instead.
That's pretty deep. He did not want to have his address be on King Drive. That's just really deep. And this is after Martin Luther King was killed, Lee Allen Jones. This is after the assassination. That's when they named... There was no way Daley was going to name a street for Martin Luther King while he was alive, you know, but when he was dead, they looked for the one street. They had to find a street in the city of Chicago that did not go where white people lived.
Right. Now, God, who was that? Chris, I think, said that if you go to any city you go to, if you see Martin Luther King Drive, run.
Right.
Chris Rock. You're quoting Chris Rock. Lee Allen, I get what you're saying. I don't think it would have really meant much a benefit for your average black resident in the city of Chicago. And when I think about Bobby Rush stepping down, Lee Allen, and Monroe, I think it's the last tie to Harold Washington. I mean, Danny K. Davis, still a congressman from the 7th Congressional District, but he was in the city council before Harold ran for, was elected mayor in 83. And Bobby Rush owes his career to Harold Washington. And with him leaving, that's it. They've effectively killed the Harold Washington movement and the Harold Washington legacy. And they intended to do that, as Monroe pointed out, from the moment that Eugene Sawyer was put into office and there was a fight among black leaders that Monroe has talked about in this show many times. And many of them on the Bobby Rush included would probably admit that they made a big mistake.
He does
admit that, right, Monroe?
Yeah, he does. He said that to me.
And so
I would
Conrad
disagree, though, Moore,
go ahead. Take it away. Go.
I would disagree. I think that the Harold Washington legacy if you look at it in a wider lens, really is as robust as it's ever been. It's just not within the African-American community. It would be with Luis Gutierrez. It would be with Chuy Garcia. It would be with Chuy. They are the real legacy right now of Harold Washington, and you can see them being very effective in doing that in very quiet ways, in very methodical ways, in very strategic ways. And so Bobby Rush would be the conclusion on the African-American side. But when you look at the multicultural aspect, it is thriving within, Chuy and with Luis Gutierrez. And so they are really setting up immigration policy. I think I was listening today. There's going to be the first person of color is going to be over the census now. A Latino, I think. I heard that on the radio today. So they set themselves up very well for 2030. And really, you know, having started that movement with that multicultural coalition, it started under Harold.
That's a good point. Chuy Garcia owes his political career to Harold Washington. Harold gave him a job back in 1984, I want to say, in the Water Department. And that he used that job to find some security for his family and so he could launch his political career. So that is a good point, Lee Allen. Monroe, do you share Lee Allen's optimism that the legacy of Harold Washington lives on, or do you share my gloom that the Dailies of the world and the Marama Manuals of the world successfully conspired to destroy that movement?
Well, they've had a detrimental impact on the Black community in Chicago. But Harold's legacy lives on throughout the United States. I mean, if you look and see how many Black mayors there are now, and it was Harold was a huge influence on that, on that, and his approach to politics, taking it out of the Chicago machine arena and making it about community groups and power to the people, if you will, trying to represent all folks. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that approach, you've had Black mayors in places where there were very few Black people, like Seattle and Denver, you know, where Blacks weren't close to being a majority. So Obama, you know, we got a president out of that. So now Harold's legacy is not dead. It's just the Chicago Black community, Chicago's Black community, after his death, they got divided, and maybe they're back together. I'm not sure. 30 years.
They're not back together. I think that what happened is there's really not been a lot of equity in the history of Black politics. You know, it's like even right now, what's kind of startling is that the people that really were successful through Black politics and the people that were able to aggregate wealth from the political process, I mean, the guys that did real estate, the Higginbottoms, the John Rogers, you know, were able to be within the 1% of the Chicago political spectrum, I think are really clueless. And I think every election cycle since Harold has been diluted with this false sense of strategy. And that false sense of strategy is what's, destroyed, probably an 80 to 90 year political legacy. If you go back to Oscar DePriest, when he was able to first get the seat, you know, in the first congressional district, and then looking at where it's at now. I mean, Congressman Rush even intimated yesterday within the summation of his career is that, we have more African-American elected officials in the history of the country. And, you know, we're going south of that assessment. It doesn't mean anything. Look at Cook County. Look at the state. You have, all of these people in leadership positions, but you have rampant crime. You have carjacking. You have threats to public safety. You have
blame that, Lee Allen. You can't blame that on the politicians. What I see is the problem with the crime rate range we have going on now is the pandemic and a lot of the jobs that criminals could do have been dissipated. For example, when back in the days when there were numbers runners and people made a living off of that, the lottery took that over. Now we have legal marijuana. And so you don't have as many kids that you can't just go out on the street corners and make a living that way. So what's the person to do? So you start carjacking and just...
Well, can I respond?
Absolutely.
Respond
to that? Absolutely.
I would say that to the Messiah complex in black politics is really what's in question here. So when you say that you don't blame the politician, I have to disagree, because they put themselves in these positions as leaders, right, with deficient leadership skills. Because anyone that's in leadership, like what you just said in a nutshell, Monroe, is saying automation. We've been talking about automation since the turn of the century. Yeah. In terms of before there were cars, before there were engines. We've been talking, economies do this, right? Economies get efficient over time. And I think that the leadership in the African-American community comes from a position of messiahism as opposed to strategy, and people that understand industry and people that are looking at how industry affects society. But like, for instance, you know, the biggest issue that's driving crime right now has been this splurge in social media, you know, essentially based on how we're communicating right now. You know, the Chicago Public Schools is really a jobs program based upon Chicago politics. All the institutions of Chicago that the African-American community runs have become jobs programs, meaning they're not resilient to real market activity. That's where the suffering comes from. And it happens across the country because we're emotionally tied to our politics, and emotions don't do well when you're trying to deal with market reality. And so, you know, that's how you get a generation that started under the Harold Washington administration and had, you know, exposure to being managers of institutions. And you can see where the resiliency of those institutions stabilized the communities where they were supposed to administrate at. It's like everything is political and nothing can be challenged administratively. And therefore, when we look at these people, we have to look at the administrative issue. Like I mentioned to you, Ben, I mean, if you look at the plan for transformation that came out of the Daley administration and Renaissance 2020, those are probably, I would say conservatively, $5 billion to $15 billion of wasted public policy. And nobody's going to be held accountable.
The plan for transformation that Lee Allen's alluded to is the plan that was hatched in the mid 90s by the Clintons and Daley to tear down the high rise CHA complexes in the city of Chicago and supposedly replace them with affordable low rise housing for the residents who were displaced. Of course, that didn't happen. We talked about that a couple weeks ago at length about Cabrini Green. We dedicated a couple shows to that one, Lee Allen Jones. So it didn't really happen. So essentially what it was an updated version of urban renewal, or what Monroe has called on this show, Negro removal, which is what it was called in the 1960s.
That's the Dick Gregory of it.
Yes. Monroe, I got to give him credit for that one. But that's exactly what it was. You know, they promised to replacement housing. The replacement housing didn't come. And you took it one step further, Lee Allen. You took it one step further, one step beyond just moving black people out of the city of Chicago. You said it has directly resulted in the crime we see today. Expound upon that, please.
I mean, you're looking at, like Monroe said, if the Harold Washington legacy has gone national and its influence, you know, based upon Chicago, then look at where the crime has gone. When you looked at the spill out of Chicago public housing, you have residents from Chicago that spilled out across the country. I think when you look at the fact of what happened in Atlanta, right? You know, Chicago people left, you know, Illinois, right, where they were being kind of, you know, marginalized politically. You go to places like Georgia and you find opportunities and opportunities to thrive in places like Atlanta. That's what allows you to get the push from urban, you know, Atlanta Metro to get Warnock and Ossoff, you know, those Senate candidates that won. You know, that's really giving, what's her name, Stacey Abrams, and giving her the push is that those people that are coming from those northern cities and coming down south, but also Chicago gang culture is down there, right? You have Chicago gang culture, you have gangster disciples now in New York City. You have gangster disciples that are in all parts of the United States and Chicago gangs. Chicago drill music culture is across the country. And this was incubated under the Obama administration. You understand what I'm saying? So when you look at the confluence of the issues that are going on nationally, a lot of that has started in Chicago. I mean, we forget the Democratic National Party had their national party here in 96. You know, what happened from 96 until now, right? We got a black president out of it, you know, a wealthy black president, the first black family. What has any of that meant? University of Chicago has $11 billion in its endowment. What does that mean? You know what I'm saying? You know, what does all of this mean? Valerie Jarrett, she was, you know, central within that plan for transformation. Where's the accountability, right? Nobody wants to be held accountable, and we just keep politicking. I mean, when you look at Congressman Rush's statement yesterday, he said you can own public service, but you can't own public office. Very intriguing when you look at the fact that there's no longer a Mike Madigan, right? You know, there's no more Frank Zuccarelli. You know, and I don't think that the people that want to be put in these positions are any better than the people that were there. In fact, I think they're going to be worse as public administrators because they don't have real models of being administrators. They have their, these are people that protect their tribes. And that's why when you get to positions where we have this transition in leadership, you don't have real leaders or credible leaders at the table. You just have people that are part of political tribes.
Frank Zuccarelli, that Lee Allen Jones alluded to, was the longstanding powerhouse in the south suburbs, head of Thornton Township, who passed away right around New Year's, I want to say. He was an old-fashioned Democratic boss and prophet, 70 years old, I believe he was, Lee Allen, when he died not too long ago. Monroe, your thoughts on what Lee Allen has to say about the impact of tearing down the projects with the plans for transformation on black political power in the city of Chicago.
When I covered Harold for the Tribune, Bill Ware, who was Harold's chief of staff, told me that Chicago was the only city in the world where they had poor people living on prime real estate. By that I mean they had the public housing projects along Lake Michigan, Robert Taylor Homes. Cabrini Green was literally 7/8 of a mile away from the Gold Coast. And Ware told me that no black mayor could ever change that for obvious reasons. Well, we lost to Daley, and Daley said about changing it. He said about turning Chicago into Paris. I went to Paris in 97 or something like that, way back when. And the thing I noticed about Paris is that it was the city itself was very middle class and wealthy, and that the poor people lived in the suburbs that ringed Paris. Mm. And that's been what's been happening here in Chicago. Gary, where I grew up, has inherited some people from Chicago's ghettos. There are other black suburbs around where, and as Lee Allen said, people have gone to Atlanta, et cetera. Yeah. So the black leaders have nothing to do with that because they haven't had power over it. That's the money people.
Absolutely. That was the plan. I've said it all along. And the first step was to make sure that we never have another Harold Washington. And by that, I mean a powerful black politician who is elected virtually as a result of 99%, 97% of black voters voting for him. And that was what the Daley years was all about, chipping away at black political power to effectively promote the programs that you're talking about. We don't talk about that in the city of Chicago, Lee Allen Jones. It's always swept under the rug. I remember Chris Kennedy ran for governor a couple of years ago, went off the reservation. I don't know who put this idea in his head, but he said that there was a plan, that Rahm Emanuel's planning department had a plan to remove black people from the city of Chicago. And oh my goodness, you'd have thought the man said that what? That the Lake Michigan is actually an ocean. You know what I'm saying? That he said something so preposterous and outrageous, you couldn't believe it. Everybody criticized him in mainstream Chicago media and all that. Oh, how dare you say that? That's an outrage.
They're all in cahoots.
Yeah, they're all in cahoots.
But to retort, wasn't Congressman Rush, so didn't he support Chris Kennedy?
Maybe Congressman Rush who put that notion in his head.
And I want to believe that. I want to believe that Amara Enya at that point was advising him as well. So I think that would have come from that discussion. But I don't give. I got to realize, you know, I'm a libertarian and I'm a capital, right? I don't want to give the black politician a pat. I think it's absurd to think that you don't bring that squarely to the African-American politician, because when you look at it, they are the principal leadership structure. They are the hierarchy of politics. It's like being a parent. You can't say that the parent was a good parent if their kids were starving. I mean, if DCFS evaluated parents that administrated like you're giving the politicians the password, that would be abuse and neglect. And they have been derelict in their responsibility. I don't want to make it personal, but their output and the sources of that lack of output is up for debate. It's up for debate. They invested in nothing and they got nothing. And that's what it is. The power structure is what the power structure is. We've known that since Reconstruction. We've known that. That's what created the Oscar de Preces.
All right. I just have to say this about free markets and libertarianism. And I feel if I say this, we'll go down a rabbit hole, Lee Allen. But I just have to say this. There are no such things as free markets.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I wouldn't disagree with you, Ben. And I wouldn't want you to get into this deep philosophical debate. When I say that, it's like I love developing student athletes and coaching athletes. That's almost like watching a football game and the offense taking the ball and running in the opposite direction. When you try to look at that and frame it within how you're looking at the political context, you're saying that you accept mediocrity in leadership when you say that the African-American politician in the last 30 to 40 years in Chicago couldn't have done a better job. Gang leadership in Chicago has been more resilient than the African-American politician.
Wow. Monroe, you buy that?
What else can you say? The gang leadership is more resilient and more entrenched in a third generation in Chicago than three generations of black Chicago politics.
The reason that we have all the shootings going on is there is no gang leadership. Because they would control that. It's not good for business to have these kids killing each other. And so if they were in control, they could discipline them. Were they able to shoot each other over social media?
When I say resilient, yes, it has fractionalized. It is now more tribalism than it's ever been. But this was created, let's go back. This all was created by public policy. This was the crime reform bill of 1994 and 1995. So let's not act as if the public policy isn't attached to the public safety issue.
Monroe, you got to respond.
That was an unintended consequence, but for sure.
But who was at the table? If it was an unintended consequence, you couldn't go and manage the pension fund. Yes, maybe you could if you were a daily relative. But if you manage your portfolio, Monroe, is much more managed than what you're talking about. You wouldn't have that prime real estate you have with that same logic you have in Lincoln Park. You were a visionary. You were a pioneer based on free market principles, Monroe. You did better as a manager of your real estate than just about 95% of any politician that's your contemporary right now.
By the way, knowing a little bit about Monroe's fiduciary brilliance, I would have to agree with that one, Lee Allen Jones. And we'll leave it at that.
That's because it was like a mom and pop operation, not a corporate.
But my point is what you're saying is you made a decentralized decision based upon your assessment. What politician can say they took a mom? Kerry Austin, political royalty in Chicago, 34th Ward, may be eliminated this political cycle. These were the people in the 34th Ward that were at the top of the political food chain in Chicago politics. The top of the political food chain is in the 34th Ward. They were the deer. They may even have been more advanced than the 8th Ward, right? They're done politically. We don't want, let's leave that. They're done. The legacy of the 34th Ward will be done in this remap. When you look at what's going on right now with Pat Dow, the 3rd Ward and the 4th Ward will be done. If not this cycle, by 2030. You don't have one African-American leader right now that has a 2030 discussion.
What do you mean 2030 discussion?
Well, the decade. Look at what's going on in 2020. You've had almost, what, a quarter of a million people, black people have left Chicago, right? You don't have anybody having a discussion saying what's going to happen when you look at the most loyal voters in Chicago are the people that are most vulnerable to COVID. They may not even be here in a decade when we look at all of the challenges that exist within our society, within the local political structure. Well, and Toni Krenwinkel is, what, 80?
Yeah, not yet, but I get your point.
She's close.
You're right. You're right. Nobody's thinking ahead to 2030. And the point about COVID ties into what I began my conversation with. How do I put this? The dereliction of duty on the part of the leaders of the city of Chicago to protecting the people who go to Chicago public schools from COVID. And their outrage when you got the health commissioner. I just shake my head, Lee Allen and Monroe, the health commissioner, the chief health officer of the city of Chicago, is getting up and acting as a political patron for Lori Lightfoot in terms of, they're sending out unbelievably conflicting mixed messages about what we, the citizens, should be doing as a practical way to protect ourselves from the spread of COVID. And
it's Orwellian. It's Orwellian leadership.
Yeah, that is absolutely.
It's Orwellian leadership. This is the issue. If we want to really talk about this political thing, Lori Lightfoot is representation of this messiah complex that we have inculcated local politics with, that these are non-political anomalies represent leadership. No, it's just a political anomaly. That's all that it is. Her leadership, and I wrote about this in The Nation, Lori Lightfoot was resilient politically when she had an adversary like Donald Trump. When she was able to have somebody to fight against and to tweet against, she looked like a resilient leader. But now that you don't have a Trump and you have to devise a strategy and plan with vision, she's failed. And not only has she failed, she's brought leadership in that has no real world experience politically. She's like a startup company and a legacy company. And this is when you create failure. She's not an executive. She has only really hurt Chicago and really hurt it in a way where you have to look at really substantial change in leadership. You don't have the political institutions going into these next political cycles. You don't even have a Leon Finney anymore. You understand what I'm saying? And Leon Finney, no matter what you want to say about Leon Finney, he was a great political organizer. Now, what was the things that were organized? But he was a political organizer. You now have an era of political opportunism at a very desperate point politically.
All right. Monroe, do you want to comment on what he had to say about Lori Lightfoot?
No.
Well, I will say this. Very disappointed about how Lori Lightfoot is handling the situation with the public schools with COVID, to the point you're making, Lee Allen. Very disappointed about
that.
No,
that's not a good job. Well, again, though, but as I pointed out earlier in this session, it's a complicated problem in that the kids need to be at school.
Nobody is saying close the schools.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, as mayor of the city of Chicago, I don't care about what they're doing in Atlanta, L.A., New York, etc. You're the mayor of the city of Chicago. It's this, the singular office in the city that traditionally we've looked up to as the person who runs Chicago. You should guarantee that it's as safe as it possibly can be. At the very least, you should make it as safe as the United Center. You should have the same protocols in place that they have to protect people who go to Bulls and Blackhawk games. There should be like rigid mask wearing requirements and good masks that everybody has and a plentiful supply of them at the door. So if a kid doesn't bring his mask, Lee Allen Jones, you know as well as I do, some kids will just forget to bring their masks. Any kid could forget to put it in his backpack at the door, a fresh mask for the kid to wear. You know, yeah, what I'm saying?
Can I go back? Could I bring something up? I want to just go through like a remember the money that Governor Pritzker put in down at what was that? McCormick Place. How much money did he spend doing that?
I forget. It was like millions of dollars. Yeah.
It was significant money.
Yes.
Okay. They have CPS was talking about taking COVID relief money to pay down the debt. Remember that?
Yes, absolutely. Like that, we talked about that. Yes.
So this is the issue that CPS has. They have more resources than they have strategy for.
Yeah.
That's not what the issue. They have more resource, and they're making it a political issue when it's really an administrative issue. If you get the people that are administrating education in CPS, if they get sick, right, who's there to even administrate online and remote learning?
Absolutely.
So the question is, CPS is a jobs program. And when you have people that have jobs and not skill sets, you make a political issue something. It's not political. It's administrative. They don't have a plan.
Yeah.
They don't have a plan. So the more they can fight with CTU in absence of producing a plan with ample resources. They don't have a resource issue. They have a strategy issue.
I hear you. Like, for instance, they bought all those computers. They bought all those computers just in case they would need them for virtual learning, and they haven't passed them out yet. You're absolutely correct. And we were talking about this where they had money for tests. They passed out, they got the test to the kids. The parents dutifully had their kids tested, and then they had no system to like measure the tests and see who had a negative test and who had a positive test. So in the end, it was a waste. You're absolutely correct. I can't. And by the way, this breaking news, the Grammy Awards were postponed for the second year in a row because of the pandemic. A new date is expected soon. And I'm saying that it's just so funny. All around us, we see evidence that we're in a serious crisis at the moment. It could pass. Monroe and I have been talking about COVID for 2 years now, Lee Allen. So I know there's peaks and valleys, but this is where we are right now. And yet you got the health commissioner.
CPS has no strategy, and they have hundreds of millions of dollars. And that goes to what we said about the failure of leadership. You can't have $1 billion to deal with an issue and have no strategy, no plan. Pat Dow, who's on the budget committee for the city council, she's announcing she wants to run for the congressional seat when there should be an audit right now of the money that CPS has spent on a program that we're still dealing with. I mean, these are not, this is almost like as bad as the money we spent in Afghanistan over the last 20 years, the loss and waste and fraud and abuse with these big government programs. And here we have a crisis commingled with it, real world crisis. And you have all the resources and no administrative resilience within the city of Chicago's African-American leadership.
All right. You mentioned Pat Dow. She, of course, is the alderwoman of the Third Ward and has been so, I want to say, since 2007 when she defeated Dorothy Tillman. And she was running for Secretary of State to replace Jesse White, who is stepping down. She dropped out of that Secretary of State race to announce today, before we came on the air that she would be running for Bobby Rush's seat. And the Sun-Times has heralded her as the front runner because she already has a campaign in place that she, for her Secretary of State campaign, she'll transform to transfer over to a congressional campaign. So it's already heating up. I'm going to ask each of you, who do you think would be, are they going to be the front runners, or who would you like to see in this race? And I'm going to start with Lee Allen because he blew my mind with a suggestion that I hadn't thought of. A frequent guest on the Ben Jarofsky show, he suggested that a she run for Congress. So Lee Allen, share with the listeners your suggestion. Who do you think would be an interesting, to put it mildly, candidate to replace Bobby Rush in the 1st Congressional District?
It would be Stacey Davis Gates from the Vice President of Chicago Teachers Union. I think she's demonstrated the political chops to go to the next level. And I would love to see her in Congress to be someone to work side by side with Speaker Pelosi. I could see her being someone that could be a more articulate version of what you see within the squad with Representative Ohan Milhar, with Representative Presley, and Representative AOC. I think she would be someone I would like to see working with, you know, Tulsi Gabbard. I believe she's a political wolf eater. And, you know, with her political chops, she comes from the Karen Lewis tree of politics in Chicago. And if we recall the late Karen Lewis, she was very vocal in going at the political establishment of Rahm and Daley. And I don't think we look at the politics of Karen Lewis and really look at her legacy serious enough to know what she represented. Had we really been behind her and supported her when she began to go at the status quo politics of Chicago. And so for that reason, I think Stacey Davis Gates is beyond prepared to go to Washington, D.C. and advocate on behalf of the 1st Congressional District.
Just a quick correction. Tulsi Gabbard has retired from Congress. She's no longer in Congress. Stacey Davis Gates, I'm a big fan of her. Everybody knows that. She's one of the most strategic thinkers, political thinkers I know in the city of Chicago. And she's very passionate. And she learned a lot from Karen Lewis, the great Karen Lewis, one of my heroes, right up there with Harold. So you kind of caught me off guard with that one, Lee Allen. People have been telling me, oh, Stacey Davis Gates, SDG, your girl, they always call her, she's going to run for mayor. You watch, she's going to run for mayor. And I always thought of her running for mayor, but a congressional candidate. That Harold, don't everybody forget, Harold Washington, before he was mayor of the city of Chicago, was the congressman of the 1st Congressional District. And he gave up that seat to run for mayor. So you caught me off guard with that.
He gave it up reluctantly. He said that was the greatest job he ever had. He said they treated him like a king and he didn't have to do much.
No, but he loved that job, Monroe. Yeah. I mean, he loved that job, and he was great for Congress because I could go on. And Harold was a very thoughtful man. He read a lot, you know what I'm saying? And he liked his quiet moments alone from the fray, away from the fray. And, so he did give it away reluctantly after Lou Palmer, everybody signed up the 50,000 voters. Monroe, do you have somebody out there that you think, not that you're going to endorse, but that you think would make a really strong candidate to replace Bobby Rush?
No, I don't. You know, I haven't been following it closely enough. Bobby stepping down caught me off guard. So, no, I don't have anything. In fact, I've been Merrick Garland just spoke. And so I was half watching that. And basically what he says is that he denounced election fraud and he said they're going to follow the evidence wherever it goes on January 6th. And it sounds like the Department of Justice is going to make it a criminal case and go after Trump. He didn't say that, but that sounds like where it's going.
Well, we are going to close the show where we began it then. Lee Allen, we began the show with the discussion of the fact that this is roughly 1 year out since the January 6th insurrection, which occurred on a Wednesday. And so Monroe and I were having our conversation, and he was, once again, he had that TV on. He always has his MSNBC on in the background. He was like, oh my God, Ben, you won't believe what I'm seeing here. And so if Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States, follows up on that one, Monroe, then we may have, even with Republicans taking over Congress, we may have a step toward justice on this, because I believe with the absence of that investigation, the plan is, as we started at the out, we stated at the outset, to run out the clock and bury this.
Yeah, well, with this, they may not take over Congress as planned now, because with this January 6th hearings out of the committee that will be taking place, I think it's going to be in prime time. I think they're going to get it in prime time. It's going to be explosive. It's going to be because there were several Republican congressmen involved in this, and this was literally a plan to take over the government. It wasn't like any bumbling through or people got so passionate at the last minute. I mean, this was an attempted coup. The only complication with this is that if you do indict Trump, if he is indicted, you've got to convict him. You know, he was impeached twice, and it only made him stronger. So as the, the old saying goes, if you go for the king, you must kill him.
Yeah.
It has to be a headshot. And I don't know if they have that or not yet.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about this one for quite a while. And so Monroe Anderson, thank you again for every Wednesday being on the Ben Jarofsky Show. And Lee Allen Jones did a great job. Bring you back really soon. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.
Likewise.
Yeah.
All right, that's Lee Allen Jones and Monroe Anderson. I'm Ben Jarofsky. I also want to thank the man, myth, the legend, pride of joy in Alton, Illinois, without whom this show would be possible. And as Lee Allen Jones, Monroe Anderson could tell you, back home in Alton, they call him Dr. D, and the D stands for DeMarvelous. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
All right.